Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. It is Sunday, October 15th, and we have a terrific show for you lined up today. Until quite recently, a position on the Federal Communications Commission was the equivalent of going into the Federal Witness Protection Program if someone was a public official. In the last 2 years, that has changed dramatically as public awareness of what the SEC does has grown in terms of media ownership, the future of the Internet, fake news, and a variety of other issues. Today, we have the privilege to be joined in a rare public media appearance by FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein to discuss what's going on at the FCC today with regard to ownership, the future of the Internet, and big media and telecommunication mergers. So join us live today for Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The reconstitution of the old Ma Bell is one step closer today. The U.S. Department of Justice has formally approved the $78 billion merger of AT&T with Bell South and did so without placing any conditions on the deal. That means the merger does not have to undergo any formal judicial antitrust review, even though the new and improved AT&T will consist of all the old Ma Bell's reach and power, with the exception of those areas of the country covered by Verizon and Quest. The only thing now stopping final consummation of the merger is a review by the Federal Communications Commission. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin has already expressed his desire to see the deal rubber stamped. But if the specter of fewer service options and higher rates seems daunting domestically, be glad you're not a soldier in Iraq or Afghanistan. There, AT&T has an exclusive contract to provide public phone service on U.S. military bases. While those of us stateside can make long-distance calls for 10 cents a minute or less, soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan are charged more than twice that amount. AT&T has also blocked the use of competitors' calling cards, a practice that's illegal in the U.S. AT&T claims the tenuous situation of doing business in dangerous parts of the world justifies the price markup, but having a monopoly and a captive customer base certainly doesn't hurt.
The coalition that we have is over 700 groups.
Joan Blades is a co-founder of liberal group Move On, and Michelle Combs is director of communications for the Christian Coalition.
Our organizations, even though we may not agree on a lot, we are very similar. We try to get our supporters out on an issue, and with net neutrality, we're allowed to do that. Without it, we would not be able to.
That's a snippet from a new documentary produced by Bill Moyers entitled The Net at Risk. This 90-minute program clearly and comprehensively explains the fundamental principle of network neutrality and how it's key to preserving open, democratic communication on the Internet. For his part, Moyers says the Internet's been a space where some of the more negative effects of consolidated traditional media have been resisted, and without network neutrality, that will cease.
Without independent journalists and independent broadcasters, we're in real trouble as a society.
Correspondent Rick Carr narrates The Net at Risk. He interviewed both supporters of and opponents to network neutrality, and he thinks legislative preservation of the principle is the only way to avoid speech discrimination online.
One of the leading spokesmen for the telephone companies and technology firms that are pushing against neutrality admitted that there would be no pushback from the current administration if one of them started to block web traffic that they didn't like.
The documentary comes at a time when Congress has adjourned for the November elections. Although there is still a chance that it may vote to enshrine Internet freedom as a point of law, Bill Moyers says phone and cable companies are already moving to change the venue of the debate.
There is some evidence that the telecoms have seen the light, that they don't think they're going to win on this in Congress because of all of the citizen protest and opposition that's been mounted. And they are moving aggressively, going out to the state because they have a lot of clout there, and they can divide and conquer.
The Net at Risk debuts on Wednesday, October 18th, with repeats planned over the following weekend. Check your local PBS TV listings for exact airtimes.
And finally, some good news for webcasters and podcasters. The World Intellectual Property Organization has apparently rejected a U.S.-backed plan to lock down all streaming media. Negotiations over a global treaty covering online audio and video stalled when the U.S. delegation demanded that a new layer of performance rights be awarded to webcasters. Under this proposal, even if a webcaster doesn't own the content they convey, they'd still be awarded copyright protection over their audio or video streams. Among other implications, this threatened to throw content already in the public domain back into the hands of a private owner. However, nearly unanimous opposition to this proposal means it will be abandoned in future treaty negotiations. The U.S. is still holding out for a global mandate that would require all webcasters and podcasters to use digital rights management technology, thereby preventing the sharing of content, even though some sharing is protected by the fair use provision in U.S. copyright law. There's a lot of resistance to that idea as well. Negotiations on the broadcast treaty will reconvene next month. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. I'm in Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we have a long-awaited program, a show that has been much anticipated. We are privileged today to be joined by FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein. Jonathan Adelstein has been on the FCC since December 2002, and he was sworn in for a second five-year term in December 2004, so he's in the middle of that second term. Before joining the FCC, Jonathan Adelstein served for 15 years as a staff member of the United States Senate, the final seven of which he worked as a senior legislative aide to United States Senator Majority Leader, then Tom Daschle from South Dakota. Jonathan Adelstein is a native of South Dakota himself, though he currently lives in the Washington area. Commissioner Adelstein, thank you very much for joining us on Media Matters.
Well, it's great to be with you, Bob. This is a great show, and I'm honored to be on it.
Well, we've got a lot of ground to cover. As I said at the beginning, and I think it was before you called in and we had you on the air, but until a few years ago, being a member of the FCC was to public service similar to being in the Witness Protection Program. I mean, people like yourself were almost entirely unknown, really, until the last 5 or 6 years with the big explosion of interest over media ownership and now a number of other issues we'll be talking about today. Today, though, you are and some of your peers are well known to a significant percentage of the American population, certainly more than any FCC members in history. I can say that that's a safe statement. And there's a lot of interest in what the FCC is doing today, and it covers a lot of territory, as you know. And I want to cover media ownership, telecom mergers, net neutrality, fake news. There's a whole range of stuff we'll be talking about on the program today. But before we go into that, let's just do a little background on what the FCC is, how it works, because I think there's not a whole lot of understanding of what the FCC is and how it works.
Well, the basics of it are there's up to five members that are appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, no more than three of which can be from the same party. So by the way the law is structured, you have at least two members of minority, in this case, not the president's party, but the Democrats. So I was appointed based on the recommendation of Senator Tom Daschle from South Dakota to President Bush, and after some struggle back and forth and quite a bit of controversy, I finally managed to get appointed. That's just an example of how it works. And so we oversee a broad swath of the economy, everything that goes over the wires and the wireline, or wireless, including, of course, the media broadcast, but also your cable, your telephone, the satellite spectrum, all of the spectrum over which everything really wireless is communicated. So it's a pretty vast jurisdiction that we have that encompasses about 10% of the national economy.
In fact, one of the things that's striking about the FCC is that unlike virtually every other regulatory agency in the federal government, like the SEC, Security Exchange Commission, or the FTC, the FCC actually awards licenses that are valued in the billions or tens of billions of dollars. I mean, there is a monetary value to your actions at the FCC that is much greater than virtually any other regulatory agency.
Well, some of the decisions we make have vast implications for the economy. For example, we just completed last month about a $14 billion auction of wireless spectrum. And we set all the rules for that to make sure it was used the best possible way. And those are big decisions about, is the spectrum going to be unlicensed? Is it going to be licensed? What are the rules? What kind of license areas do we sell? Do we sell big swaths of the country, or do we sell little localized licenses? So many of these decisions that tens of millions or hundreds of millions, and as you said, sometimes even billions, are riding, are made by us on the FCC. So certainly not the witness protection program anymore. I think we're well outed by now.
Well, it's never been a witness protection program to large corporations. They've had you all on speed dial since day one. Literally speed dial in terms of who the companies you're dealing with are. Now, the FCC has five members, as you pointed out, three from the president's party as a rule, two from the other party. There's also a large staff. I mean, how big is the FCC?
Well, we only have 2,000 employees. Oh. It might sound like a lot to some people, but it's actually one of the smaller federal agencies, given how much work we have to do.
2,000 members. And among the five members of the FCC, is it, do you work as a team, or how does the, are you in constant consultation, the five of you deliberating together, or do you work on your own? How does that operate?
Well, you know, it varies depending on who the chairman is and what the style of the chairman is. Right now, Kevin Martin's the chairman, and he, you know, we talk once a week, maybe sometimes more often when there's an intense negotiation going on. But we have a rule. It's called, ironically, the Sunshine Act, which prevents more than one of us from talking to another at a time. So it would be kind of awkward if three of us run into each other in the hallway. We can't talk about substance anymore. We have to talk about the weather, what we had for dinner last night, because the idea was they didn't want backroom deals made by people without being in public view. But the result really has been that there's more backroom deals, but it's by staff and not by the commissioners. We have our staff, and they can get together, but we can't. So it kind of makes for strained communications, because if you want to talk to everybody at once, you've got to kind of do shuttle diplomacy where you run around and talk to everybody. And, you know, each commissioner is different. Each way of communicating is different. And it's quite complex. And it depends on the issue. I mean, most of what we do is really nonpartisan. Probably 90% of what we do is done by consensus. And whether you're a Democrat or Republican, if you say you want something a certain way, and most people will go along if what you're saying makes sense. It's in the area of media ownership. We've had some controversy, so that your listeners probably think it's always this heated, but in fact, a lot of what we do is much less controversial than that.
Our guest today on Media Matters is FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein, joining us from Washington, D.C. today live. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Commissioner Adelstein, the telephone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Before we go to the phone lines, I do want to talk about one other area of some controversy, Commissioner Adelstein, that you've been involved with, just a breaking story this week, which is the proposed pending merger of AT&T and Bell South. This merger, which would create the largest telecommunications company in human history, was approved by the Department of Justice and then had to get cleared by the Federal Communications Commission. One of the five members of the FCC recused himself, the new member, Robert McDowell. So it was four members left. And it turned out they didn't have the votes to approve the merger. Can you talk a little bit about that without violating some sort of FCC secret code?
Well, I've got to be a little careful about it. I normally don't talk about mergers publicly when they're pending, but I made an exception this week because I was so outraged by the Justice Department decision to approve this merger without any conditions. Mm-hmm. Well, I can talk to you at least procedurally about talk to you about what the Justice Department did. Basically, some people will remember that it was the Reagan Justice Department, of all places, that broke up AT&T back in the 1980s in such a way that you would have a long-distance company and local phone companies called the Box or Bell Operating Companies, like Verizon or Quest or Bell South, AT&T. Well, actually, it was SBC until they merged with AT&T. Mm-hmm. And then recently, AT&T merged with SBC, which was one of the large Box, and Verizon merged with MCI, and we approved that on a bipartisan 4-0 basis, because at that time there was not a fifth commissioner that was actually approved by the Senate at the time. So it was a 2-2 commission for over a year, and we got a lot of work done, and was controversial, and Mike Copps, the other Democrat, and I managed to ensure there was protections put in place for consumers. So this time around, we normally rely on the Justice Department, given its historic role in breaking up AT&T. Essentially, you see Ma Bell being put back together again here, and the Justice Department totally took a dive on it. They decided to attach no conditions, no restrictions, just wave it right through, raise the white flag, and send them on by. And we were really appalled by that because, first of all, it was totally inconsistent with the decision they'd made only less than a year earlier in the decision, for example, of SBC to buy AT&T. In that case, you had a long-distance company that was buying a one of these box, and the Justice Department decided that it would require divestiture of certain buildings in the territory of SBC that were basically captive of AT&T, the long-distance company. Mm-hmm. Now that the new long-distance company, I know this is complicated, but the new long-distance company now is owned by the company that wants to buy Bell South, which is another Bell operating company.
Mm-hmm.
And there's exactly the same situation in their territory. You've got the long-distance company coming in, and there's some lines that are captive to the old AT&T long-distance company. And the Justice Department decided buildings that are identically situated in Bell South territory didn't deserve the protection they thought was deserved of those mergers in the SBC territory. I say, why would they do that? It's totally inconsistent. You could call it hypocritical if you want. I don't think that would be inaccurate. But there's a reason for it. After they did these were fairly scant conditions, and after they did them in the earlier merger, there was a lawsuit, and the courts determined under this revisions of what's called the Tunney Act that allows the courts to review the adequacy of Justice Department merger review to look at the way that the SBC-AT&T merger went. And there was some indication that the judge thought that the Justice Department didn't go far enough. So what did the Justice Department do the next time around? They did even less. Why? Because if they have a consent decree, if they required the same conditions of the second merger as the first, they'd be subject to this court review. So in order to avoid court review, in my opinion, I can't see what other reason there would be such an inconsistent decision, they took a dive on this merger, just basically flaunting the courts and saying, we don't want you looking at the way we approve these things, so we're just not going to let you do it. The next day, we were scheduled to vote on the merger. So we're sitting here watching justice take a dive before the court acts, because the court action could be imminent in that case, and we're asked to vote the next day on it. And then because we're not near an agreement, we just gotten the Justice Department decision on Wednesday. We were asked about on Thursday. The chairman moved the meeting back to Friday without consulting me. And we were no closer to getting an agreement. There was some negotiations going on. We got, for example, 9 o'clock Thursday night, we get a complex proposal. And we're supposed to vote the next day at 11, two working hours later. I mean, it was just a really unfortunate process. So Mike Copps and I wrote to the chairman and asked him to open this process up to the public, to allow public comment on the conditions that were being proposed by AT&T, to let the public decide and let experts decide, people like you and other academics around the country, experts, other interested parties who might be competitors. Let's open it up and have a real thorough discussion of this. So the chairman did that and scheduled another vote for November 3rd. So we have another couple weeks now that we're going to be reviewing it, and it is open for public comment.
Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone number here, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. You're listening to Media Matters and WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We're talking about, right now with Commissioner Adelstein, the proposed merger of AT&T and Bell South, which would create the largest telephone company in the world, and which, unlike the old AT&T, which dealt primarily or almost exclusively with telephone transmission, now would really be, we're talking about the trunk lines and the core, heart, and soul of broadband internet transmission in the United States, the center of the internet system, once this merger goes through. Commissioner Adelstein, you and is your cohort, Commissioner Copps, were able to stop the merger from being run through fairly quickly without any review this week. What sort of conditions are the sort of things the FCC traditionally would put on a deal like this? And if you're allowed to talk about it, what are the sort of things you think the FCC ought to consider as it monitors whether this deal will be allowed to go ahead?
Well, that's the kind of thing Bob, I can't really talk about because we're in the midst
of it. I figured as much.
We're in the midst of negotiations on it, and I can't negotiate.
Fair enough.
Press, even though your venue would be as good of one as any, I'd say. And well, you understand this merger better than almost anybody else in the country. But Let me just say it's complex. We're looking at issues. We have looked in the past at issues like network neutrality, which I know is of great importance to you, and we're going to do the best we can to ensure that if this merger is approved, it's done in such a way as it's done in the public interest. That's what the law requires. These things have to meet a public interest standard, and sometimes I think agencies like ours forget about that and think that somehow what's more important than the law is whatever the merging parties want, what they think is in their interest, but that's not what the law says. And Mike Hopps and I have been very determined to actually implement the law and not be captured by those we are supposed to oversee.
We have a couple of callers who've been waiting very patiently to get on the air with our guest, Jonathan Adelstein, the FCC commissioner, who's joining us live on the phone from Washington, D.C. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to commend you for your work on the FCC. I appreciate it a great deal. Many of us do. I propose that there's actually an inverse relationship of mergers in the public interest, and especially in terms of service. What I've seen over this time of this mega mergers, particularly, we can see it in the banking industry with Chase taken over, there's less service. There's less interest in the public interest. And I question the Justice Department. I wonder, justice for whom? It certainly doesn't seem lately that it's served in the public interest. I'll just make a comment, and I'll go off the air on anything that you want to pick up on. I also question this, one of your FCC, the Republican commissioners was a lobbyist, a former lobbyist. And I think there's a whole issue here about lobbyists coming into government and then, or the other one worked for the government, and in a short time they're in a lobbying firm. So anyway, just a small short thing here. A few years ago I was asked to participate in the focus group, and we didn't know it was supposed to be for telephone companies and all that, and so it was here locally, and it was subsequently about SBC. And actually, it turned into a big gripe session. I mean, a lot of people are very unhappy that there isn't any competition. But anyway, I'll go off and let you comment on any of these, but appreciate your work.
Thank you very much, caller. Commissioner Adelstein, he raised a number of issues. If I can just paraphrase one of them, which is the point about lobbyists. You know, I think that most listeners probably aren't aware of the fact that much of the contact the commission traditionally has had with the public is primarily with lobbyists.
Well, that's certainly true. We have a very high-paid and effective lobbying group that lobbies us. It's quite remarkable. Every year is a ballroom at the Hilton Hotel, the biggest ballroom in Washington, D.C., that's filled. It's what's called the Federal Communications Bar Association. 2,000 people, most of them lawyers, that are paid most of their large salaries just to work on the poor five of us. And they put us in the middle of the room. It's sort of symbolic. In the head table, like in the center of the fishbowl, with thousands of lawyers surrounding us like sharks, and we're just the chum in the middle. But they're a very good bunch. You know, the thing about lobbyists is they're paid for being smooth and smart and nice, so they really can be very wonderful people. You know, you don't get to the top of that profession by being anything but socially graceful. But you wonder about the public. You know, what about the people out there that we're supposed to represent? And if our constant time is spent with those who are well-paid by people who can afford to pay them very well, it's a problem. And what's also a problem is that you think about an ex-FCC staffer, and we have some great ones, and, you know, we get paid government salaries, and eventually you see the really good ones have kids, or they need to send their kids to college, and they grow up, and they move on to be lobbying. But guess who can afford to pay them the most? You think it's the public interest groups? You think it's the folks that are out there just working for the broader interests of the American people? Obviously, the bigger the company and the more profits they have, the more they can pay. So the cream of the crop gets bought up by the very most powerful corporations that we are supposed to oversee. And I think that that's sort of an institutional effect that can be very damaging. And it's not really fair, because it's an unfair competitive advantage, essentially, those who are already good and already are the most advantaged. And it's troubling to me. But that doesn't mean I won't talk to these folks. My job is to do that. I'm fortunate that I've been able to spend my entire career in public service and have never been in a private sector, so nobody can accuse me of having any conflicts of interest here. But I can see why, you know, some people who might have been in industry will come in and out. And there's quite a revolving door in Washington, and I can see why people out there in the public get fairly disgusted by it.
Now, onto the caller's final point. When you came into office almost immediately, you did something that was revolutionary, I think, in the history of the SEC. In fact, I can guarantee it was revolutionary in the history of the SEC, which is that you agreed to do a series of public hearings around the country, not necessarily official SEC hearings, but just to meet with people in communities around the country to hear what their take was on media, on broadcasting, on the internet, to get feedback from them. So you would get alternative information from just the well-paid lobbyists we've been describing, which are paid a fortune to contact you and discuss issues with you. Roughly how many of these public hearings have you done, Commissioner Adelstein, in the past 4 years?
You know, I might have lost, I'm sure I've done over 20 personally, and I got to give a lot of credit to my colleague Mike Hopps, who was mm-hmm. there about a year before I got there, and mm-hmm. had just begun this process, and I enthusiastically agreed that it was the way to go. Let's get out there and talk to the American people. After all, particularly when it comes to media, the law is very vague. I mean, the only statute, again, is this public interest standard, and how can we know it's in the public interest unless we go out and talk to the public? How could we possibly think somehow we know better inside the Beltway, listening to all these fancy lobbyists who come to our office, rather than just going out and talking to people? And it was extremely instructive. I've got to say it was a great idea, because wherever we went, all across the country, we learned that people thought letting big media get bigger was a bad idea. I mean, almost to a person. We just came, for example, from Los Angeles, where we got the FCC to hold an official hearing, not just one of Mike Hopps and I's unofficial on-the-road guerrilla hearings. And 99 out of 100 people literally were opposed to media consolidation, which I thought was fairly consistent with what the national view would be if you take a poll of it, that media consolidation is just not a good idea. We had one libertarian come and say he thought, let the free market ride. And, of course, people believe that. But when it comes to the media, people feel differently. They recognize it's not a free market, that the public owns the airwaves, and that just not anybody who wants to can set up their own radio station and communicate. They have to go through the FCC, and there's limited space on the dial. And as you said, that space on the dial can be worth $1 billion in a market like LA or New York. So we learned what people thought, and it really instructed me. I really took it to heart. I didn't realize, frankly, you know, how strong the view would be and how articulate people would be and how much true wisdom there was out among the American people, how articulate they could be, as your caller just was. So I learned a lot. I went around the country. I learned about different situations in different communities. And, man, it's been a fantastic idea, and I would commend it to anybody in government who really believes in serving the public interest.
Our guest today, Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein from the Federal Communications Commission, talking to us live. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. Our phone number here, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for the commissioner, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We've got a lot of ground to cover today. And, Commissioner, before we go back to the phone lines, I do want to raise the issue you mentioned before, which is network neutrality. You and I were speaking in Milwaukee about a month ago. We had a chance to meet before one of these public hearings in Milwaukee. And I mentioned to you all the work in Congress that was being done around the issue of network neutrality. And you made it clear to me that that was not purely a congressional issue, that you had a strong interest in this as well. Could you talk a little bit about, what your take is on the issue of network neutrality?
Well, so far, the Congress has been deliberating extensively on it, but the FCC has actually acted on it in a couple of circumstances, in both circumstances thanks to the demands of Mike Hopps and myself. I mean, first, we demanded a set of internet principles and won it back when it was a 2-2 commission in order to get some concessions on another regulatory matter. We established principles that people can basically go wherever they want on the web, they can attach whatever devices they want, and they can't be blocked. We couldn't get it to go further to get some kind of non-discrimination provision to ensure that the Internet remained as open as it could be. But we did begin the ball rolling. And then when the large bell companies merged with the long-distance companies that I mentioned earlier, AT&T, SBC, and Verizon MCI, we made those principles conditions of the merger so that for a period of time, those large companies would have to abide by the principles. So we've actually made some substantive progress on it, but a lot of people think those principles don't go far enough, that we need to get to some fifth principle, we call it, of non-discrimination to ensure that the vibrancy and openness of the Internet, which has been its hallmark from its inception, remain the way that it works and that there can be no large companies or oligopolies that would dominate and be able to extract unfair and anti-competitive rents by commanding in a competitive way their internet network.
Well, in effect, privatize the internet because they would take assume control over who could be on a website and who couldn't, which has traditionally been open to all.
That's right, and they might affect the way that the markets flow so that only the largest, most well-connected sites, again, are the ones that people can access quickly, and people would lose control over where they'd be able to go and how fast they'd be able to go and whether they could get alternative suppliers of video content, for example. So it's very critical, especially as we see media consolidation, that we keep the internet open, because in an era of massive media consolidation, it's very hopeful to see things like YouTube, where which used to be independent, but you know now it's part of this new emerging empire of Google, but where people can post their own video and people can sort of have their own independent voices heard without going through the Goliath. And occasionally things will break through, and it's kind of a democratic forum, the internet, and we want to keep it that way.
Our guest is Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein from the FCC. I should add, for those interested in the issue of the future of the internet and the question of network neutrality, that our companion station, WILL Television, Channel 12, will be broadcasting a brand new Bill Moyers documentary called The Net at Risk, The Internet's Future, and it will discuss network neutrality at the center of the show and the future of the internet. That's this Wednesday, 8 o'clock on WILL Channel 12. And for those of you listening to the show and podcasting, Commissioner Adelstein, we have now tens of thousands of weekly listeners outside our area, thanks to podcasting. I think this is being aired nationally on the PBS network, so just look for your local listings to find out when it's going to be aired. Our guest today on Media Matters, again, Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein of the Federal Communications Commission. We've still got a lot of stuff to talk about, but let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Lafayette, you're on the air with Commissioner Adelstein.
I just wanted to change the focus a little bit here. As it stands right now, unlicensed signal-generating devices are not allowed to interfere with those that are licensed to transmit. And the problem seems to be more and more that these interfering devices are connected to large, complex antenna systems, such as a whole neighborhood telephone system. And if you did not have them connected to the large antenna, they would not be a source of troublesome radiation interfering with multitudinous other stations. But since they are, I'm wondering, they're very, very difficult to locate. And what I'm wondering is if there's any possibility of having the regulations changed so that the owner of the antenna system takes some responsibility for the radiating signal.
Are you talking about interference with other unlicensed uses?
No, interference with licensed users.
And what licensees are getting interference in this kind of a case?
Oh, there will be large numbers of radio stations that will be interfered with, and but you can't find the actual device that's generating the signal. All you can really find is the wires that are radiating the signal.
Well, we have a number of regulations in place to prevent that kind of harmful interference to broadcasters. We have very carefully limited the number of devices that can be approved for unlicensed use to those that would not interfere with the with licensed uses like radio broadcasting. Now, sometimes people will break the rules and they will jigger devices that might be stronger than the rules allow or are communicating over a frequency that we don't authorize. You know, there's not a lot we can do necessarily about criminals. We try to track them down. We have field staff that go out there and try to shut that down. But we would want to make sure that we don't, kill the forest for the trees. I mean, we don't want to prevent unlicensed uses from flourishing as they have. Again, you know, in an age of media consolidation, I really believe that unlicensed wireless uses have exploded in ways that can create a new and open dynamic that can counter some of the concentration we've seen in other areas, similar to the kind of concentration we've seen, for example, in the telecom sector as well, which we've been talking about earlier in the show. We want to make sure that there's a vibrant wireless broadband availability out there, and unlicensed makes it possible to quickly get that up and running. Now, to the degree people are using unlicensed consistent with our rules, they will not interfere with licensed users. Just this week, we did act on a on a rule to expand the use of unlicensed devices in what's so-called white spaces, which are the areas between television station broadcasts. The broadcaster's a little nervous about it, but we try to do it in such a way as there would be no interference, and particularly those channels would be used in rural areas, for example, where there's not necessarily a broadcaster nearby. And we always try to balance the existing licensee's right to be operating uninterfered with the need to expand unlicensed uses. And I think we do need to promote that Wi-Fi revolution, if you want to call it that, because it's opened a whole new means of communication and broadband that can fight that oligopoly that we see, or really the duopoly between cable and the phone companies, having the only two wires that can provide broadband.
Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein, our guest today on Media Matters. Commissioner, just a couple months ago, the FCC, under Chair Kevin Martin, launched a new review of media ownership rules. And the Los Angeles hearing you mentioned that took place last week or the week before was a key part of that. What is being reviewed? What's the status of the media ownership review? And what's the process look like from here on out?
Well, the last time we tried massive deregulation, 2003, under then-Chairman Michael Powell, there was an uprising, as you know, and were so instrumental in leading across the country against it. And fortunately, just to make it a quick summary here, the courts overturned that. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals threw it back at the FCC and said, go back and start from scratch. So we have an opportunity now to get it right, to do it completely differently than we did. Not clear whether that's what we're going to do or not, but what the status is that just recently we did launch a proceeding to respond to the court, and it was a wide open proceeding that basically says, what do you think of media ownership? It didn't give a lot of specificity. I dissented in part from that because I thought it would only be helpful this time if we actually told the public what we're going to do before we do it. I thought we needed an agreement that we would have a further notice that would tell people actually what we were about to do substantively before we did it, but we did get that agreement. So right now it's like a blank check to further media consolidation. If the majority can just muster the will and the votes to do it, they could allow any amount of deregulation they want, and of course we'd send it back to the courts. But we're trying to educate them and the problems that come with media consolidation. So one of the things we did get agreement on was that there would be a half a dozen hearings officially across the country. We don't think that's enough. I mean, we just did one in Los Angeles, and I had already done an unofficial hearing in Los Angeles, and I think you could do six hearings in Los Angeles alone.
I mean, as I gather, Commissioner Adelstein, that the Los Angeles hearings, there were two of them, one at the University of Southern California and one in a suburban location. They were both packed to the gills with people, weren't they?
There was a lot of people that came to both of them, and very articulate folks. We had the creative community come out. We had, you know, world-famous directors and actors and producers and writers come out and all say to a person that additional media consolidation stifles creativity, stifles new ideas, allows for homogenization as the middle-level managers of these large media conglomerates will try to dumb everything down to the lowest common denominator, and independence is thrown out the window. We heard a consistent argument that's why television is what it is today, and if people are frustrated with the sort of level of homogeneity, you know, the Banana Republic Starbucks style that they get, then they can credit to media consolidation for a lot of that. So we really learned a lot from that hearing. Of course, we have a lot more to think about, you know, in terms of...
Have the other hearings been scheduled yet, Commissioner Adelstein? The public official hearings on media ownership, the other five that Commissioner Martin, Chair Martin, has agreed to?
No, we have not heard about them at all. It'd be nice if we got a little bit of advance notice about when these things are going to happen, but we haven't gotten any indication as to where or when we're going to go. As a matter of fact, the last one in Los Angeles was kind of done on short notice, and they wanted to do it in 2 weeks, and we barely had a room ready by the time we got out there. It doesn't really help us with our scheduling, but we haven't heard where the other five are going to be.
You know, we have a full bank of callers waiting to speak with FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein. We're going to get to all of you, I promise. But before we do, turn to the phone calls. One last point on this media ownership review that's going on. It happened that when Commissioner Chairman Martin was being going before the Senate Commerce Committee, dealing with his reappointment as a member of the FCC a couple weeks ago, that it emerged through Senator Boxer that there had been a study done by the FCC staff a couple of years ago of the effects of concentrated ownership on the quality and amount of local television news. And the study had been found that local ownership made a big difference, that chain ownership really cut back on resources to local news on local television stations dramatically. I was even surprised by what it found, and it was done apparently by two of the top economists at the FCC. Yet this study apparently was suppressed. No one knew about it. Someone had ordered it to be destroyed. It was, to put it mildly, a black eye on the agency when this came out. Where does this stand now?
Well, the study in question has been put out publicly, but only after it was outed by somebody, some whistleblower somewhere. And I thank God that that was put out in the public domain, but it's kind of sad that another study that was sponsored by the FCC that didn't look at any actual broadcast that concluded that it was okay to have more consolidation was put forward, and this one was buried because it didn't fit with the conclusions of both the media giants and the leadership of the FCC at the time.
I mean, that's an absolute outrage, isn't it?
It sure is. I mean, that was done at taxpayer expense. But more importantly, we have a right, all members of the commission, to that kind of information. An independent study that was done with valuable information, we need to get this right. We don't need to pursue some ideological agenda or some agenda that promotes the needs of the companies that are already interested in buying more outlets that are already massive as it is. It's really outrageous. I was outraged by it. I thought Senator Boxer did a real public service by bringing that to the attention of the public. And there was another study subsequently that it turned out was not, you know, properly credited. So we have another study that's pending now, too, that needs to come out. There's been a lot of money spent on. So, you know, the suppression of information is not consistent with the idea of a communications commission. That's supposed to be our middle name. It's not the Federal Suppression Commission.
Well, is it possible for the FCC to go ahead and vote on changing media ownership rules as long as there is this issue, the fact that core research that has been done by FCC staff has been suppressed and ordered destroyed, that might go again, that might influence the actual crucial policy decision being made?
Well, I think these decisions are so important, we should wait until the full record is before us, until all the studies are completed. For example, one thing that Chairman Powell did right after the big uproar in June of 2003, in August, he said, I hear you, and I'm going to start a task force on localism.
Mm-hmm.
And that task force kind of went into remission, if you will, and we didn't hear anything about it for a while until some members of Congress started asking about it just this year. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's going on with that? And all of a sudden, you know, Chairman Martin said, well, I forgot about that, but let's see what we can do. And now he's compiling a summary of what they came up with earlier, but there's another hearing that we have to do that hasn't been done. There are studies that are currently pending on that, and there's no report of the task force. The idea was we shouldn't be acting on media consolidation until we know what the impact is going to be on localism. So I think you're exactly right. We can't put the cart before the horse here. We better make sure we have all the data in before we act, because once you let a big media company get bigger, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube.
Our guest today, Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein from the FCC, joining us on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. There are a couple phone lines open. I'll try to get to you if I can. The number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. There's lots of other issues we want to talk about, including fake news and obscenity. We'll try to get them today, but first let's go right back to the phone lines. Line 1, Charleston, you're on the air with Commissioner Adelstein.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Two things. Ronald Reagan, the great communicator, when he broke up, in my opinion, the telephone monopoly, did so to minimize and to atomize the unions. And the second thing I would like to say, and maybe your guest could comment on both, was the getting together again of a major oil company, I think Standard, Exxon, and such as that, which had fallen under the antitrust laws at the turn of the 20th century. I'll hang up and listen, and thank you very much.
Certainly. Commissioner?
Well, all I can say is that this antitrust division of the Justice Department is potentially the weakest we've ever seen. I'm looking at it from the point of view of this one merger that was waved through this week. I think it was rather unfortunate that there was no real analysis done, that they said, no problem, we can let this go. I mean, the old days, the Justice Department used to take seriously its obligation to prevent anti-competitive combinations and to recommend ameliorative steps to remedy anti-competitive positions that large companies would be in. This is now an $80 billion merger. This is one of the largest mergers in history, and it's the largest telecommunications merger ever done. And the Justice Department can't think of one thing to do to protect competition and consumers. I think it's outrageous.
Our guest, Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein, let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, San Francisco, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein of the FCC.
There's a lot of loose toothpaste in America today. I wonder if Commissioner Adelstein would briefly describe the jurisdiction of the FCC over the Internet. And I had a more specific question. I'm curious about what he knows about private business, PR firms, or even the government hiring individuals to pose as, say, free agents to interfere with the Internet or specifically with different Internet content. People going online to pretending to be just regular individuals but promoting certain values or policies. That's it.
Okay, thank you very much, caller. And Commissioner Adelstein, I think that second part of the question goes directly to the work you've been pioneering and leading in the Federal Communications Commission to stamp out, expose, and eliminate the huge rise in fake news and payola being done at commercial television stations.
Right, it certainly does. The broader question about the Internet is a little different in that our jurisdiction over the Internet is not nearly as pervasive as it is over broadcasting. Over the Internet, there's all kinds of charlatans and strange things that go on, but the sort of atomized nature of it, the decentralized nature of it, means that the government has sort of taken itself out of the business of regulating anything besides fraud or, you know, illegal practices. But when it comes to the broadcasters, we have more precise jurisdiction over the content. We don't have a lot, but the only thing we really have is both indecency, which you alluded to, and also the need for what's called sponsorship ID. That is, if somebody's advertising on television, they have to let the public know about it. You can't go hire some talking head to say something on broadcast television and not let the public know that this is paid for by or sponsored by whoever it is that paid that talking head to say something. And I've been insistent that as we see the increasing commercialization of the media, that there is a adherence to the law, that the public has a right under the law to know who's trying to persuade them.
The commissioner, just to interrupt, I apologize, but the Center for Media and Democracy did a major study that located scores of instances of commercial television newscasts airing broadcasts that were in effect fake news, that were paid for by some PR firm or something, not generated by journalists, but presented as news, and a clear violation of the law. And you sort of, what's the status of this now at the FCC?
Well, I insisted that we launch an investigation, and I actually got the chairman to agree to do it. We now have letters of inquiry that have gone out to all of the stations that were implicated in that report to ask them what their answer is. Did they disclose to the public that somebody paid for that segment? Is there adherence to the anti-payola rules that we have? So we are actively investigating that. And, of course, people are making all kinds of excuses. Some companies have owned up and said, we're sorry, it was a mistake, and it won't happen again. But as I talk to people in the industry, these things aren't isolated mistakes. The 79 instances that the Center for Media and Democracy came up with are just the tip of the iceberg, from what I can tell. I mean, video news releases had deeply implicated themselves into the daily life of the newsroom. And, again, the reason goes back to media consolidation, or one of the reasons. I think the reason for that is that these newsrooms are under increasing pressure. They're cutting staff. They're eliminating investigative journalism, community journalism, all because these big media conglomerates are demanding more and more profits, and one of the places they look is to cutting back on the quality of the news operation. They might chase a police car around town if there's a good chase or follow down, robbery, mayhem. If it bleeds, it leads. But they don't have the money to go around and do the real kind of local news that indicates what's happening in that community. Or to do investigative pieces that, again, can be very expensive and apparently aren't worth it because it doesn't return enough profit to the shareholders. Back in the old days when you had more localized media, I think there was a sense of responsibility to the community a local owner of a local TV station would make sure that that news would do a good job, because he had to go to the coffee shop in the morning and face the people, and he was a part of that community. Now, you see increasing multinational conglomerates that have real imperatives every quarter to report huge profits to Wall Street, and they don't have that sense of local community responsibility to the same degree anymore. And so the result is that rather than pay for an expensive news team to go out and actually do new news or real news, they just take some video news release that's put together by some corporation, slap it on, and pretend that it's news. Sometimes they'll even do their own voiceover using the script that was provided by the large corporation. And it's not fair to the public, but, you know, under our rules, they can do that as long as they disclose it. Say, this was brought to you by such and such a drug company, or this was brought to you by, you know, this large electric company. But they don't even do that. They don't even give their audience the respect of telling them what they've done. And why don't they disclose it? Because it's embarrassing. They know it's disgraceful what they're doing. They don't want the public to know that they're, rather than actually doing real news, just slapping something on that came from some corporation, but that's what they're doing.
And Commissioner Adelstein, you're too modest. I do want to let our listeners understand that were you not on the FCC, investigation would not exist. This issue would not be an issue that would be at the heart of what the FCC is doing right now. You are to be congratulated.
Well, thank you. I'd also commend the Center for Media Democracy. If the public interest groups didn't do studies like that, then I wouldn't have anything to go on. But when somebody comes up with something so damning as that, I think it's incumbent on us as representatives of the public to enforce the law.
Our guest today, Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein from the FCC. We've only got about 5 or 6 minutes left. We have a couple of callers who have been very patiently waiting. Let's get to the phone lines now. Line 2, Terre Haute, Indiana. You're on the air with FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to get back to one of the issues raised by an earlier caller. It seems that under Part 15, there's supposed to be regulation of emissions of computer-based equipment. And I would contend that much of the interference, particularly on AM 580, is due to industrial power conditioning equipment that does not regulate and keep it out of the lines. Comments? I'll just get off and let you respond.
Okay, thank you very much. Are you familiar with these sort of complaints, Commissioner?
I've heard about them. I don't know why we're getting such a volume today, but Part 15, for everybody to understand, is the basically says that you can use devices that don't interfere that operate under a certain amount of interference. For example, your garage door operators are wireless devices that do that. My kid got a birthday present that's this little dinosaur that operates wirelessly, and if you look on the back of that, it says this is a Part 15 device. I'm on a phone right now that is wireless and also is compliant with the FCC rules. Now, you know, whatever interference the caller was referring to, if it was a Part 15 device, it's non-compliant if it's interfering with AM 580, for example. If it's not a Part 15 device and somehow it's causing emissions, spurious emissions, we can investigate that and basically shut it down if it's a serious issue. I mean, our job is to protect broadcasters' right to broadcast. What's interesting about that is, you know, broadcasters expect, for example, commercial broadcaster on FM 97.1, that they're going to be able to broadcast and nobody's going to mess with them. They want the government to come in and protect them from interference, and we're happy to do that. We give them a monopoly over 97.1 FM or 580 AM. But in return, all we ask is that they serve the public interest. And unfortunately, we do a very good job, I think, we try to, of protecting broadcasters' rights to non-interference, but we don't do such a good job of getting the public interest benefits in the bargain for the public whose airwaves are being used.
Commissioner Adelstein, we have one last caller I want to get to, but before we get to that, I do want to touch on an issue I've mentioned, the obscenity issue. After Janet Jackson's performance at the Super Bowl a couple years ago, the FCC, with congressional direction, instituted a series of large fines on television and radio broadcasters for incidents of obscenity. These are very controversial, and what's your position on this?
Well, when I first got to the FCC, I think we'd virtually stopped enforcing the law. The law does prohibit the broadcast of indecent material. What confuses a lot of people, I think, is that they say, I can listen to that. It's not a problem if I see these things as an adult. But that's not who we're trying to protect. We're trying to protect children. And adults actually have a constitutional right to indecent material, not obscene material. There's this distinction in the law, but indecent material, like what Janet Jackson did was indecent, not obscene. But that's First Amendment protected, but the courts have actually given the government a very limited right to inhibit constitutionally protected free speech for purposes of protecting children over broadcasting, because broadcasting is so pervasive. So we can only do it during the hours when children are listening, from 6 in the morning until 10 at night. Generally, broadcasters try to keep it clean even after those hours, but they don't always, and there's nothing we can do about it one way or the other, because that, again, is protected under the First Amendment. So we do have this right. Congress asked us to do it. As I said, I believe in enforcing the law. I don't question the law. I enforce it. And I think people broadcasting indecent material have to be punished for it, and that needs to be properly sanctioned. I felt the Super Bowl was an example of that. I was sitting there watching it with my kid. Fortunately, my kids weren't old enough yet to really appreciate the sort of nature of what was going on. But a lot of families were pretty offended by it. We had over 500,000 complaints. You're sitting there with your child trying to watch television, and something comes on that you don't think is appropriate for your children. You thought you were okay because you were watching broadcast TV. That's sort of a clean zone for families. When that spirit is violated, it's our job to jump in there and do something about it. Now, we might have taken this too far recently. I had the dissent from a case where we found that a blues documentary that used some salty language was indecent because, you know, when we're talking about documentaries or news, there's a higher level of protection that we normally would afford under the First Amendment to that kind of communication. It's not always possible to take all the language out. For example, the commission unanimously agreed that Saving Private Ryan, which has a lot of that movie, Spielberg movie that has a lot of language in it that might not be appropriate for children, was necessary to the film. That's the way that soldiers are going to talk during a war. But why is it then not okay for blues musicians or people in that field, which is also quite loaded with that kind of language? It's not clear how you distinguish one from the other. So we have to be a little bit more careful, I think, in being consistent in how we define these things. And maybe the pendulum has swung too far, where now we are limiting speech that should be protected under the First Amendment and calling it indecent. We have to be careful not to overstep our bounds and have a chilling effect, which I think we're now having.
Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein, our guest. We have time for one last caller to the FCC commissioner from Farina, Illinois. Farina, you're on the air with Commissioner Adelstein.
Hi, thanks so much. There's so much to talk about. Bob, could you expand your show to 3 hours or something? Anyway, I want to just comment that Ronald Reagan, the great communicator, quietly reversed the fairness doctrine. Could you comment on that? Thank you.
Yes, during the Reagan administration, the FCC did away with the fairness doctrine, which required that there would be equal time for all different viewpoints. So now you see all this fulmination on talk radio that isn't met with the other side. And the idea, of course, at the time was that you would have to have a balance, because not everybody could have a radio station. If somebody was given the privilege of having a broadcast outlet, they had to make sure that they didn't use it sort of to just blast one side or the other. But that's what's happening now. All we have left, really, now that the fairness doctrine is gone, is the media ownership rules. And the idea of the media ownership rules is if you have a lot of different owners, then you won't have any one with a megaphone big enough to dominate the discourse in a community, a mini Citizen Kane, if you will. So I think that given that we've done away with the fairness doctrine and it doesn't show any signs of coming back anytime soon, we better be doubly careful about not permitting undue media consolidation. Otherwise, you not only have no requirement for a balanced show, but you have one owner that can control way too many outlets in a community that they can use for their own political agenda. And we're increasingly seeing that over the broadcast airwaves, that owners with a political agenda are imposing that on their viewers and listeners.
Commissioner Adelstein, thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. It's been an honor to have you as our guest, Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein of the Federal Communications Commission. My name is Bob McChesney, urging you to come back in 166 hours. We have our special two-hour fundraiser next week. Please join us with Amy Goodman and John Nichols. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, and be sure to watch the Bill Moyers documentary, 8 o'clock this Wednesday on Net Neutrality. See you next week, guys.
It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with a slight chance of showers, the high in the mid-50s with southeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, cloudy with a chance of rain after midnight, not as cool with the low in the mid-40s and southeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, showers likely with a high in the upper 50s and southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. She says she's fed up with conservative spin in what she calls the right-wing church of hate. Commentator and author Susan Eskridge joins us and takes on Ann Coulter and others in her new book, Soulless.
I don't believe in censorship, but at a certain point, responsible people have got to stand up and say, enough is enough. And purveyors of hate don't deserve the forms that Ann Coulter has gotten.
Also, journalist and best-selling author Richard Minotaur shares some of the top media myths he says undermine the war on terror. Regular commentator Cornel West reminds us why voting preserves our democracy. Plus, we'll pay tribute to baseball hero Buck O'Neill, who died last week. This hour of the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI,